Hello, it's Wednesday, the 1st of July. I'm John Dennis. Today, cracks in the Great Firewall of China as the Beijing government backs down on plans for new censorship software.
What we've seen over the past 10 years is that the Chinese authorities have fought a running battle with the internet.
It's game over for Russia's casinos as a gambling ban is imposed.
I dropped into one yesterday and they were sort of busy dismantling the kind of neon sign with a kind of winking coronet, and talked to a couple of punters who were sitting mournfully around a roulette table.
And John Malkovich, the Hollywood actor, on his latest role, an Austrian serial killer.
If you can't know when a husband's going to suddenly kill his wife and his children, how are you going to know what Jacko Unterweger is going to choose?
But first, today's news with Bill Overton.
Michael Jackson's body is to be put on show at his Neverland ranch before his funeral. California police are discussing a 100-mile motorcade to carry the body from Los Angeles with his family. Meanwhile, there are reports he left his estate to his children and their mother. But the family are preparing to go to court to claim he didn't leave a proper will. And the promoter of Jackson's comeback tour says the London show could now become a memorial tribute. A teenage girl has been rescued from the site of yesterday's Yemeni plane crash in the Indian Ocean off the Comoros Islands. The 14-year-old was found swimming among dead bodies. The United Nations General Assembly has voted unanimously to demand the reinstatement of the president of Honduras. Manuel Zelaya was in New York to address the assembly after he was ousted in a military coup on Sunday. He plans to return to the country on Thursday, accompanied by senior politicians from the Organization of American States. But the interim president, elected by the Honduran Congress, says only an armed invasion could restore Zelaya. Barack Obama's finally got an overall majority in the US Senate. After a six-month legal tussle, the Democrat Al Franken has been formally elected as the new senator for Minnesota. He won the election by only 300 votes out of nearly 3 million cast, and his Republican opponent has finally conceded. Michael Martin, who resigned earlier as Speaker of the House of Commons, is elevated to the House of Lords today. But the Guardian's learned the Independent Appointments Commission warns his presence in the Lords could diminish its reputation. The Commission's job is to vet candidates for the Lords, and it's written to the Prime Minister opposing Mr. Martin's appointment. The Guardian, Sun and The Mirror carry the story of Michael Jackson's body going to Neverland on their front pages this morning. The Star leads with a leak of his will under the headline, Jacko Leaves Dad Out of Will, claiming it's revenge on his bullying father. Otherwise, the papers choose a range of lead stories. The Times believes supermarket giant Tesco's emerged as potential buyer for the mortgage lender Northern Rock. The paper says Gordon Brown wants the nationalised bank to be sold back to the private sector as soon as possible. The Financial Times says the European Union's competition commissioner may insist on the Lloyds banking group being broken up. Lloyds was merged with HBOS to protect the banks against collapse during the credit crisis. The Telegraph reports the government is planning help for elderly people forced by ill health to go into care homes. The paper says ministers are planning to end the system. That means many have to sell their own homes to pay the costs. They'll be able to either take out insurance or pay the state a one-off payment. Finally, Andy Murray is once again all over sports pages before his quarter-final match at Wimbledon today. He's called Iron Man in the Mail, saying he's fit and ready. The Mirror shows him playing head tennis. The Independent says he's feeling pumped up. And The Sun has a picture of him doing press-ups without his feet on the ground under the caption, I won't crumble. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
The Chinese government has announced a last-minute climb-down on plans to introduce new censorship software. It had hoped that, from today, every new computer would contain the Green Dam Youth Escort software, which would have blocked not only pornographic and violent content, but also politically sensitive material. Jonathan Watts is in Beijing.
It looks very much like a last-minute climb-down. It seems that there was some debate within the government about this software, which has stirred up amazing amount of online hostility in China and also come under fire from foreign governments, including the US and including criticism from the European Union. So it may be that, alternatively, it might well be administrative problems of putting into practice such an ambitious effort at censorship.
Well, as you say, it is very ambitious. I mean, is the Chinese government able to enforce such censorship?
It seems not in this case, at least so far, which is good news for anyone who believes in free speech. What we've seen over the past 10 years is that the Chinese authorities have fought a running battle with the internet. As the number of netizens in China has increased and increased to around about 300 million now, the authorities have tried an increasingly sophisticated set of techniques to try and control what information they're able to access. So they have keyword filters, and they impose self-censorship obligations on search engines and so forth. But the fact is that the internet keeps growing beyond them, and that people are able to find a way over the Great Firewall of China, as the censorship system is called, at its outer limits. And also that one way or another, if people want to find information, they can do so.
So how significant is this climb down? I mean, does it mean that the government will go ahead with these plans some point in the future?
That is the very interesting question that I think will be asked in the days ahead. We don't know what is in their minds when they're doing this. Are they just going to fall back a little, build up their plans again, try to convince foreign governments and foreign computer manufacturers that it can be done and it must be done, and that they're determined to push it ahead, or whether they've decided that, you know, they've gone a step too far this time, and that there's less political damage from climbing down than there would have been from pushing ahead with something that was considered as massively intrusive by a great many Chinese netizens, including a lot of young netizens who normally are quite apathetic about censorship and internet controls.
Jonathan Watts. Well, China's not the only country where an authoritarian government has sought to limit political activity by censoring the internet. Iran's recent crackdown by the government included blocking websites to prevent the spread of inconvenient information. But how have Western technology companies assisted authoritarian governments in censoring the internet? Bobby Johnson, our technology correspondent, is in San Francisco.
Well, there are really, I suppose, two threads of this. One is in helping governments with the kind of the hardware and the basic technology that they use, and that's the stuff that Cisco Systems, for example, has been criticized about in the past, and companies like Juniper Networks. These are the guys who provide the switches and the routers and the real gubbins that runs things. And then on the other side of things, you have the kind of informational censorship, which you know, is where Google and Microsoft and Yahoo come into things. Now, they're often accused of being complicit in censorship by agreeing to the whims of say, the Chinese authorities and censoring results that you might find on Google in China or on Bing.com, which is Microsoft's new search engine.
And this has come into sharp focus, really, after recent events in Iran.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that, you know, people have been campaigning and worried about this for a long time, but it kind of drifts in and out of public consciousness. I think the recent news from Iran and, you know, everything we've seen there, and the way the government has reacted to the population by restricting their communications, trying to crack down on things, have really made people look again and say, hang on, what role do Western companies have to play in this? Can we affect things? And there was a story a couple of weeks ago about Nokia Siemens Networks, which is a joint venture between Nokia and Siemens, the two European telecommunications companies. And they've provided some of the systems that Iran uses. Now, in all of these cases, certainly the hardware ones, the companies say, look, we're not doing anything illegal. We're selling this country the same equipment that we would sell to providers in America or Britain or wherever, and then they're choosing to use it in a repressive fashion. But what's started happening again is this movement to resurrect a piece of legislation in the US which would punish companies who are complicit or engage in sales with repressive regimes. Now, that's called the Global Online Freedom Act, and they've tried to put it through a couple of times before and failed, but now it's got the backing of some human rights groups. Amnesty, Reporters Without Borders are pushing it, and they're hoping that maybe the spotlight that's on it from the Iranian situation will help finally get some legislation through to regulate this activity.
Bobby Johnson. And there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/technology. Also on The Guardian's website today, Stephen Brook considers the power of TMZ. That's the showbiz blog that broke the news of Michael Jackson's death. Stephen Brook writes, guardian.co.uk/media. Elizabeth David shows Tim Hayward her cookery book collection, and she reveals the worst recipe ever, guardian.co.uk/food. And Zaha Hadid talks to Charlotte Higgins about her Bach chamber music hall for the Manchester Festival. That's at guardian.co.uk/arts. Pilots and 30,000 other airport workers will not have to carry identity cards from September. The Home Secretary Alan Johnson said yesterday he was abandoning plans for a trial scheme to go ahead. I asked our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis, which parts of the ID cards proposals have been scrapped.
Alan Johnson, as the new Home Secretary came in, said he'd review it. He's looked at it hard in detail and he's chopped off a few bits of it. There was a compulsory scheme to start this autumn for pilots, a compulsory trial whereby they'd have to have identity cards to be able to go to work, them and about 30,000 other airside workers in London and Manchester. And he's dropped that part of the scheme. And he's also, there were further long-term plans to introduce compulsory identity cards for critical workers at key rail stations. And they've also decided that compulsion would be counterproductive in those areas as well. So the argument about identity cards being used to counter terrorism perhaps looks a little weaker today after his deliberations. But I think the most important fact about the announcements from Alan Johnson is that having looked at it, he's really decided to keep the identity card project on the road, and it's indeed going to accelerate certain parts of it, where he's trying to invite young adults to be early adopters by paying £30 for a standalone ID card, mostly which they might use, he said, to either go clubbing on a Friday night to prove their age or perhaps like to travel around Europe, because it's valid as a travel card around Europe. But I think what's important behind this announcement today is that he's pushing ahead with a batch of regulations through secondary legislation, which will effectively make it compulsory to be on the National Identity Register for anyone who applies or renews their passport. And I challenged the Home Secretary about this, and he agreed that that if you did apply or renew for a passport as a result of these regulations, which MPs will vote on today, Wednesday, and also another set next week as well, that if you apply and renew your passport, you will automatically be put on to the National Identity Database. And also, if you don't update your details every time you move, for example, you don't have to do that for a passport now. If you don't do that, then you could face fines of up to £1,000 a time. So there's an element of compulsion already in the scheme. And effectively, ministers are saying that the scheme remains voluntary because you don't have to have a passport. Well, the argument from the No to ID people is that it's not much of a voluntary scheme if by not being on the ID register, you can't leave the country.
Really, the ID project's alive and well, at least until the next election.
Oh, I think so, yes, and probably beyond as well. The Conservatives say they're going to carry on with a biometric passport and the voluntary biometric passport, which raises the question about what they're going to do about the databases. And it may well be argued, and it does already by the people running the Identity and Passport Service, which is now called jointly a single body, Identity and Passport Service, that they need a database to administer their passports. So it's going to be an argument at the election between those who allegedly want the government arguing they're in favour of voluntary identity cards and the Conservatives saying they're in favour of a voluntary passport scheme. So it's going to be a narrow difference, that one.
Alan Travis. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, why a study of puffins might explain a dramatic fall in the numbers of seabirds on Britain's coastline.
So it looks all fairly good for this year, but it's a one year. What we don't know is how that relates to other years.
But first, Russia's first casino opened its doors almost 20 years ago following the end of the Cold War. But from today, gambling is banned across most of Russia, as Luke Harding reports from Moscow.
Well, this ban covers pretty much all forms of gambling across the Russian Federation. It includes casinos, which are very popular in Russia, and especially with oligarchs who have been known to drop eye-watering sums of money in them, and also slot machine parlours and halls, which have proliferated everywhere in the 2 decades since the fall of the Soviet Union. I dropped into one yesterday, and they were sort of busy dismantling the kind of neon sign with a kind of winking coronet, and talked to a couple of punters who were sitting mournfully around a roulette table. But as of last night, all of that is history, all of that is gone, and gambling appears, for the time being at least, to be finished.
This law was proposed by Russia's Prime Minister Vladimir Putin in 2006, when he was president at the time. What's behind this?
I talked to one rather fed-up casino general manager yesterday. He refused to give me his name, but he would sit down with me and have a cup of tea. And he was saying that partly it appears to be an attempt by the government basically to take over or streamline, if you want to be more charitable, what is actually a sort of successful private business. These casinos are all privately run in Russia. And the other thing he said was that he said that he thought that Putin had a mysterious grudge against the casino industry dating from his early years back in St. Petersburg when he worked in the mayor's office. Now, that's just anecdotal. I can't verify that. But that was a kind of another intriguing nugget. But either way, the main point is that he's gone ahead with this. We all thought that given how much money is involved, given the fact that there's plenty of corruption in Russia, that somehow the Kremlin would reach a deal with these casino owners, but it hasn't.
Will this law be enforced?
Another very good question. I think it'll be enforced for a week. I think there'll be a flurry of inspections and activity with officials racing up and down across Moscow and down Novi Arbat, where all the glitzy casinos are with their kind of bad Rococo statuary. And then I suspect what will happen is that a lot of these less high-profile gambling halls will reopen. Either they will mutate and reinvent themselves as blackjack or poker halls, which are apparently still legal, or they will sort of carry on underground and simply pay off officials to turn a blind eye. Most people I've talked to have been fairly realistic about this. This is Russia after all. And they've suggested that gambling will survive. The other thing to say is that the Kremlin has actually set up four special zones where gambling can legally take place, but the only problem is that they're in very remote parts of Russia, and at the moment there are no casinos there, and people who've been there have discovered a couple of bricks and a cow. So obviously, for the moment, that's no answer.
Luke Harding. There's been a steep and alarming decline in seabirds across the British Isles. Numbers have fallen by 9% in just 8 years. Scientists working for the National Trust are trying to find out why by studying puffins, as Severin Carell reports from the Farne Islands off the coast of Northumberland.
So I'm sitting in the former lighthouse building on Brownsman Island in the Farne Islands. This is the former home of Grace Darling and her father William, who were the lighthouse keepers who famously rescued a boatload of sailors stranded after being shipwrecked. And I'm with Dr. Richard Bevan, who's a zoologist from the University of Newcastle. And Dr. Bevan is here on the Farne Islands for the National Trust, helping to investigate puffin numbers. Last year, puffin numbers along the northeast coast of Britain collapsed suddenly, and some would say catastrophically. And many zoologists were left very worried about whether this might mean there was a significant shift and change in the biology of the North Sea. Now, Dr. Bevan, can you explain to me why you're here and what you're trying to do?
I'm here to investigate sort of the biology of the puffins and look at sort of how this is changing between the years, particularly after this sort of sudden decline in the population of the puffins. And this year, what I'm doing is to start looking at some new bits of research using GPS tags and what we call time depth recorders to actually monitor where the birds are going when they're not on the islands, and also what they're doing in terms of their foraging.
Well, so at this point we're simply taking what was called the biometrics. These are the mass, the various sort of lengths of wings, etc. That gives us some indication of the status of the birds, if they're sort of in good condition, and at where the birds are going.
We've been advised to wear hats coming out here. People have come off the islands with bloody scalps. Now being dive bombed by Arctic terns, which are pecking at my head with their sharp red-orange beaks. And I've had 3 hits on the head. They're all getting very agitated because their chicks are under their feet. This is like Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Dr. Bevan, do you feel more optimistic this year compared to what you found last year? I mean, given that the population has been as high as 50-odd thousand, is it possible that this year it may suddenly start creeping back up again?
Absolutely. So all the indications are that this year is a good year, not just for puffins, but for all the seabirds on the island. That the puffin chicks are growing well, the adults are certainly bringing in huge loads of sand eels of large size, so it looks all fairly good for this year. But it's a one year. What we don't know is how that relates to other years. You know, so what's going to happen next year? Are we going to see a year like last year, or are we going to see a continuation of the success of this year? We don't know. So it's important that we actually keep monitoring to be able to compare between years.
Severin Carell reporting. John Malkovich, star of Dangerous Liaisons, Con Air, and of course, Being John Malkovich, is taking on the role of an Austrian serial killer in a new opera. The Infernal Comedy opens tonight at the Ronecker Theatre in Vienna, where Malkovich spoke to The Guardian's Kate Connolly.
Everybody wants to believe in the possibility of redemption. Everybody wants to believe in the possibility of rehabilitation for ourselves in large or small ways. It's important. It's important for us to believe that about society. But, you know, there are people who, I'm not saying they can't be redeemed, but they won't be. And so it is a cautionary tale about where our sort of projected fantasies of redemption sort of hurl themselves out into the night, not knowing if the ground is 10 inches below or 200 stories. And so there's definitely cautionary tales. And I think you have to be careful what you wish for. And there are certain movements that get behind cases like this. And in their defense, only history tells if there was. If Jack Unterweger came out and wrote some novels and became a journalist and ended up being a kind of, you know, greeter at the Beverly Hills strip club down the street, no one would ever, you know. Or if he even wrote some good literature, nobody can know that. I understand. But still, it's a cautionary tale. Be careful what you wish for. And you can't know, if you can't know when a husband's going to suddenly kill his wife and his children, or you can't know when a wife is suddenly going to set her husband on fire and drag him from the back of a pickup truck, how are you going to know what Jack Unterweger is going to do? And you see, to me, these aren't political questions, but I don't know of a lot of left-wing people who would look at that and say, oh gosh, that turned out to really work out well, that decision. Boy, you have to be careful about stuff like that.
John Malkovich talking to Kate Connolly. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey were the producers of today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.